From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the world's biggest music streaming service makes a deal with the world's biggest maker of smartphones. And no, it's not Apple. Then director Desiree Akhavan talks about her new film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, and her issues with a movie rating system.
If a film shows female pleasure, it is NC-17. And, you know, you just can't go. It's pornography. It's lewd. And that's... It just, America is afraid of female sexuality.
And Guatemalan singer Gabby Moreno and country rocker Radney Foster lend their voices to immigrants at the border. All that coming right up. Spotify has made a deal to be the default streaming service on all Samsung devices. And yes, Samsung sells more phones than Apple. Although Spotify is still the biggest music streaming platform, its announcement comes in response to Apple Music's recent growth. The latest report shows Spotify with about 83 million users and Apple with a little more than 50 million. But Apple has surpassed Sweden's music streaming giant in the United States and Japan, two of the biggest music markets in the world. I spoke with Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw about what Spotify hopes to accomplish through its new partnership with Samsung.
Spotify is really eager to get more people onto its service, especially the free service, because the balance that Spotify strikes is they have both a free and paid. The paid is how they and all their rights holders, their partners, make most of their money, but the free is really the funnel that they use to bring people into the broader Spotify ecosystem. And so if you make it so that the app is available or kind of offered to you to download right as you're getting and setting up your new Samsung phone, that's likely to mean that more people are at least going to sample the app, maybe they like it, and then they stick around.
Is this partnership exclusive? And if you're a Samsung user, how does it actually end up directing you to Spotify? Is there some sort of automatic launch?
There is no world in which you're only going to see Spotify and Samsung phones. That would really fly in the face of their kind of stated mission of being neutral, and it would limit the number of people who could use it. One of the advantages that Spotify has on Apple is that it's not tethered to one particular device. As for how a Samsung user is going to encounter it, the best I could glean from what the executive said yesterday was that when you get your new Samsung phone, say that the new one is the Galaxy Note 9, you will have some kind of something comes up at when installing or setting up your phone that will say, do you want to download Spotify? And then Spotify will also have closer integration on some other Samsung devices, TVs, this smart speaker called Bixby, which I think will just make it easier to get into Spotify, skip songs, things like that.
I want to ask you about smart speakers. You mentioned Bixby. Is that more or less Samsung's answer to Amazon's Echo? And how popular is it?
It's a lot like Amazon's Echo. You know, all these big tech companies now have their smart speaker. It's funny, you know, they for all the talk of innovation, they do tend to copy one another with features and products an awful lot, and smart speaker has been one area where there's been a lot of competition of late. Amazon is still the most successful player in the space as far as I know, and Google has made a big push with its Google Home. You know, I know that Samsung was showing off a new version of its smart speaker at an event in New York yesterday.
So Samsung is trying to compete in the mobile phone device market. It's also trying to compete in the smart speaker device market. Is part of the idea that if you ask to play music on your Bixby, it will point you to a certain music provider that might be Spotify and not Apple Music?
Exactly. Samsung has flirted with creating its own entertainment services in the past. There was some talk about it developing a live TV service and a music service, all these things. And it's ultimately decided that it's better to work with kind of the companies that excel at making services. So if you're going to do that, why not connect with a neutral party like Spotify that is, in fact, a rival of your rival, Apple? You know, I look at this really as enemy of my enemy is my friend, rather than kind of direct people to an Apple Music service or even to a Google service. They can point people towards Spotify, which is competing with Samsung's rivals in other areas.
So earlier this year, Spotify went public, and unlike Apple, Spotify is a pure streaming play. So we really know almost day to day how Wall Street is reacting to what they're seeing in the Spotify numbers. Overall, what has Spotify shown in terms of profit and loss, and how has Wall Street reacted to this news?
Wall Street has liked what it's seen. Spotify's stock has been up pretty consistently since it went public. Spotify's growth in users has continued. You know, it had particularly strong growth in paid subscribers in the most recent quarter, less strong growth in the on the free side, which is, again, why they're making some of these deals. Spotify still loses money. You know, this is going to be a problem for Spotify moving forward. But for now, investors are just okay with Spotify losing money, provided that its user growth continues, and trusting in Spotify's leadership to figure out how to turn a growing business into a profitable one.
So if you look in the streaming world, there seems to be room for Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and other companies to coexist. And if you look into internet search, you would say Google is pretty much the category killer. So where might the fight between Apple and Spotify play out? Is it going to be one company rising above the other, or can they peacefully or even not peacefully coexist?
I think they will not peacefully coexist. In video, no one service has everything, and so you end up paying for multiple services if you want to watch different shows. Music is somewhere in between, where no company got such an advantage in scale that it vanquished all competitors and kind of built a moat that nobody could surmount. But because these services are very similar, you don't necessarily need to subscribe to more than one. So I think what you'll see is you'll have two or three, maybe four players kind of be the default music services. And it may come down to what device you own. If you have an iPhone, you might be a little more likely to use Apple Music. It may come down to your age or where you are. Spotify is more popular in Europe because it is a Swedish company. Apple is more popular in other parts of the world. And that's just how it's going to play out moving forward. The real question for the industry is, how big of a market is this? Are there going to be 400 million people who pay for a music service? Are there going to be a billion people? And how much of it will be regionalized? You know, in a country like India, it's mostly local players that have had a lot of success. Spotify has yet to launch there. But when Spotify does get there, will it be able to compete with a local player, or will that still be a parochial market?
Lucas Shaw is a media and business reporter for Bloomberg. Lucas, always great to have you on the show.
Likewise. Thanks, John.
And regardless of which service you use, there's new music to stream today from Nicki Minaj, plus the soundtrack from the upcoming film Crazy Rich Asians. Coming up, filmmaker Desiree Akhavan on her teen coming-of-age film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. There's been a string of pretty great movies lately that are about teenagers, but don't really fall into the usual cliches of the teen movie genre. Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade, and now Desiree Akhavan's The Miseducation of Cameron Post. Chloe Grace Moretz plays the title character, who is sent off to a Christian boarding school designed to turn gay teens straight. Even though it's been discredited, so-called gay conversion therapy is still legal in dozens of states. The film is based on the novel of the same name by Emily Danforth. Akhavan read her book when it came out in 2012. In the intervening years, she wrote, directed, and starred in her first feature film, Appropriate Behavior. It's based on her own experience coming out as bisexual to her Iranian-American family. When I spoke with Desiree Akhavan about her new film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, I asked her what her reaction was when she first read the novel on which her film is based. And just a heads up, there is some frank talk about sexuality in our conversation.
It was the most honest depiction of being a teen I'd ever read. And then on top of that, it was the only queer depiction of being a teen I'd ever read. So I gave it to my girlfriend at the time, and she read it and adored it and said, you need to make a movie of this. And I hadn't made a feature yet at this point, and it felt very ambitious. So I made my first film first. And then while I was touring with that film at festivals, I shared the book with my producer, and I was like, one day in 10 years, we will become mature enough to make this film. And, you know, she read it and the next day looked into getting the rights.
So in your recent past, you wrote, directed, and starred in a web series called The Slope about a lesbian.
I will say I co-wrote and co-starred. Yeah,
but
with Ingrid Youngerman.
Co-made a web series. You're working on a new Hulu series called The Bisexual.
And there was an episode of The Slope called Conversion Therapy.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
I'm wondering how all of these things tie in. It's obvious at first glance, but do you think there's a deeper thematic connection between the stories that you're trying to tell in your web series, in your Hulu series, and in this film?
I think it's immoral to take up space in someone's life with 90 minutes of narrative that doesn't matter, that is inconsequential. I want to tell stories that are entertaining and that have something to say, and I have so much to say. So the narrative tie between all these stories is there are things I have to say. There's so much I want to say, and at this moment in time, a lot of it has to do with being queer, and that's how the bisexual happens. I was just like, why does this word make me so uncomfortable? When I was doing press for my first film, everyone's like, bisexual Desiree Akhavan, bisexual Desiree Akhavan. And it felt like they were like, bedwetter Desiree Akhavan. And it made me uncomfortable because I was like, well, it's factually true. I am bisexual. And yet I hate that everyone's calling me that. And I really wanted to explore why I was so uncomfortable with something that I knew was true.
Well, isn't there a story as well about your parents when you came out saying, yep, well, if you like guys, why don't you just hang out with guys?
Of course. And I understood that complaint. You know, it was like, why are you choosing to make our lives so much harder?
So the novel is about a lot of things. And the gay conversion story really doesn't come in until a couple hundred pages in. So when you're thinking about what it was in the novel that you wanted to preserve, how did you make the choice? Because there's a lot there and you focus relatively narrowly, yeah, on the latter parts of the book.
Yeah, and it's funny, as a reader, my favorite parts of the book are much earlier, and I didn't set out to make a film about gay conversion therapy. That wasn't my goal. I loved the book because of the tone. To me, it was exactly what it felt like to be a teen, which means, you know, the angst and the heightened state of emotions and the drama mixed with the banality of being a teen, mixed with the lack of control over your own life, and then mixed with the joy of discovering things for the first time, having friends for the first time, smoking weed, having sex, all those discoveries being just as strongly euphoric as heartbreaking as the worst ones were. And that's what the book did for me. And during the adaptation process, Cecilia, my co-writer, and I really had to divorce ourselves from the outline, the step-by-step scene guide of those last 200 pages, and instead figure out, how do we chase that kernel of emotion that we felt in the tone of the book? And for us, that was about interweaving the different stakes and the different points of view. I think it's a very funny film. It's a very dramatic film. And in my heart, I was thinking about John Hughes and The Breakfast Club.
The better parts of John Hughes.
Yes, not the casual
sex,
rape.
Yeah, casual
or
rape.
Or the racism.
In 16 Candles. One of the ironies of God's promise in the film and in the book is that Cameron feels ostracized in the real world, mm-hmm, that she doesn't know people like her, and yet she goes to this place and suddenly she has a family. And that seems to be a very important element of the film, that you're cut off in the real world, but oddly in this place that is trying to punish you and change you, it's where you can find kinship.
For sure. And I think most people can relate to this who don't connect to their own families, but queer people especially, that a lot of your journey in life is finding your chosen family. And that's one of the joys of this place for her, is that she finds people who speak her language for the first time.
You don't really seem like the kind of person that'd be here.
Why? Because I'm such a magnet?
No, just...
I didn't have a choice. Did you?
We're talking with Desiree Akhavan. She's the director and co-writer of The Miseducation of Cameron Post. One of the things that you are clearly very intentional about is how you're going to shoot women having sex together.
Yeah.
You shoot these scenes of passion as they appear to be unfolding almost in real time. It's somewhat clumsy, but when you're thinking about what you want to do, it feels authentic, but how is it often done wrong? Are you trying to kind of correct the way that women having sex are typically shown?
Well, I don't think I do anything creatively on the basis of what not to do.
Okay.
I think personally, I want to chase where my taste is and what excites me. So I'm really interested in showing sex as, oh God, the word authentic can be interpreted so many ways. Authentically. I mean, as honestly to my own experiences as I can
share, but also my own imagination. Like, I wasn't sexually active as a teenager. You know, I never had sex in the back of a car. All these scenes in the film are projections, but also informed by my own experiences as a queer woman. Mm-hmm. And also giving a lot of freedom to my actors. I let Chloe Moretz and Quinn Shepherd, who plays her partner, Coley, have free reign over that back of the car scene. I set them up. I let them rehearse by themselves. I mean, you get a sense of each actor and how they like to work. And that was our first week. And I could tell Chloe had a lot to say, and she didn't want to be backseat driven. And I wanted her to feel empowered in this moment. She was 19 when we were shooting, and I was asking her to have sex with a girl in the backseat of a car. And when I got to set, we had just shot prom. So this was in the back of the prom location. And it was an actual high school, and the whole crew was there. The lights were everywhere, and I just got all of them out. I kicked everyone off set. I kicked myself off set, and I hid with the monitor in a building nearby. And it was just Ashley Connor, our cinematographer. The focus puller hid underneath the car, and it was Chloe and Quinn. And I thought, you know, if I see something I don't like, I'll make a note. But there was nothing I didn't like.
Wow.
And I think just letting young women express themselves is like shockingly rebellious and revolutionary and made for the best sex scene I could have shot.
You and I know that you can kill a couple thousand people in a movie very violently and be rated PG-13. But heaven forbid that two women have sex and that a nipple is shown, because that's an automatic R, yeah, if not worse. So your film is actually being released unrated, right?
Yeah.
That's clearly a decision. What do you hope is accomplished by releasing it unrated?
I hope that we don't alienate the audience that we hope to attract. We would definitely be an R. And, you know, if there was any sign of cunnilingus in this film, we would be NC-17. That is a fact. That if a film shows female pleasure, it is NC-17 and alienating. And, you know, you just can't go. It's pornography. It's lewd. And America is afraid of female sexuality.
But a guy can get oral sex from a woman.
How many images have you seen of a girl on her knees bobbing up and down? I mean, that was one of the first images I saw in film as a kid. I saw Trainspotting in the cinema at 11. I went to go see that. I love movies. I've always loved movies. My brother snuck me in. And it boggles my mind that I knew about giving head at 11. I knew what that meant. And I did not realize a woman was capable of masturbating until I was 16.
How much of your life was informed by pop culture and films?
Everything.
So had a movie like this, obviously it's impossible because it's your own, been around when you were growing up and figuring out your sexual identity. How important would a movie like this or other movies that we're seeing now, what would that have meant to you?
It would have meant everything to me. Yeah.
It's sad.
No, it's good.
It's sad that you didn't have that. I mean, because straight white people get to see themselves on screen every hour of every day.
I'm proud of what I've accomplished. Yeah. I'm proud that I get to have the opportunity to tell stories that haven't been told before. And I'm proud of the connections and the courage I've had in my life to stand up for what I intuitively believed in but didn't have any signs were okay and palatable to anyone beyond myself. Like, I didn't see it being okay in a film when I came out. And I'm glad I have the opportunity to do that for someone else, and I'm glad that I was still able to come out.
Desiree Akhavan is the director and co-writer of The Miseducation of Cameron Post. Desiree, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Miseducation of Cameron Post is in limited release starting today. Coming up, there's a new wave of protest songs about U.S. immigration policy. We'll hear from two artists about their songs.
All my family's dead and gone.
Protest songs are an important part of American popular music, and there's a new wave of songs about U.S. immigration policy that have been released in the past few months. You're hearing a bit of one called Beyond the Border by the L.A.-based songwriter and singer Bee Beeman. And then there's the Texas country singer and songwriter Radney Foster. He tells us why he turned an older lullaby of his called Godspeed, Sweet Dreams into a topical song called Dulces Sueños.
I'm a singer-songwriter, and I was born and raised in Del Rio, Texas. I wrote Godspeed, Sweet Dreams for my oldest boy when he was 5 years old. His mother and I had divorced, and she had remarried a Frenchman, and after a custody dispute, moved to France with my son. So I wrote this lullaby just truly as a love song to him, just letting him know that, you know, I was his dad and I cared. And I thought about all the things that you do when you're putting a little boy to bed, a little four-year-old, five-year-old boy. And, you know, we would read stories and, you know, Superman's in pajamas on the couch.
Godspeed, little man. Sweet dreams, little man.
I was having coffee with my wife. Said how much I ate, because to me, you know, separating a child from their parents, having grown up on the border, you know, in a bilingual home in a community that's 80% Latino, and understanding enough about the politics of the mess that's happening in Central America, you know, politics and the drug trade, you know, just what could we do? She said, you should figure out how to sing Godspeed in Spanish. You know, a prayer for the children at the border.
Caminos duros y aguas anchas. Vuelas alto en tus sueños. Duerme bajo de la luz de la luna. Y te amo. Godspeed, mija. Dulces sueños, pequeñita.
I hope it changes people's hearts. I think that that puts a face to it. It puts emotion to it. It can win people over in ways that an argument cannot.
Godspeed.
I've closed my shows as the last encore with this song for decades. You know, I don't know if I can speak for the country music community, but I know that I can speak for my audience for the most part. Even when they disagree with me politically, they see my heart and they see that I'm going to move towards things that are heartfelt.
Pero puedo cantar. Godspeed.
That was singer-songwriter Radney Foster, and that segment came to us from our friends at public radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. And now a song by a musician who is herself an immigrant. Gabby Moreno moved to L.A. from Guatemala 18 years ago to pursue her musical dreams, and lately she's been collaborating with producer and arranger Van Dyke Parks on her next album, which is due this fall. But they recently released a song called The Immigrants. Here's Gabby Moreno.
I always tell people now that I feel like an angelteca. I've been living in Los Angeles for 18 years. That's half of my life. But I'm still not a citizen. I'm still just a U.S. resident. Can I feel part of both? Is that so bad? You know? My name is Gabby Moreno. And I was born and raised in Guatemala City, and I came to the United States when I was 19. I love singing songs from Latin America, whether it's from Guatemala or Mexico or Peru or Argentina. And it felt good for me to be introducing this kind of music to an American audience. I met Van Dyke Parks, and we started talking about music from Latin America, and he told me how much he loved it and he felt a strong connection with it. And so we said, well, it would be great to do a little project where we bring in songs from different countries of Latin America, as well as songs from the United States, and try to bridge the two hemispheres. We don't want to build a wall.
So much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the NYPD.
And he was the one who brought to my attention the song The Immigrants.
Am I an immigrant or am I a new slave? Made for old brutality.
So the song originally was written in 1998 by David Rutter for a Haitian refugee who was severely beaten by New York City police. And now we decided to change the lyrics to make it more relevant for the whole nation and not just New York City.
So much trouble in the home of the brave and the land of the free.
We had this song ready to go, but we had no idea that it would be so relevant right now, especially with what we're seeing right now, that they're being separated, kids from their parents. It's like, what is this? What have we become?
Is it that man has lost his reason?
I think it's an important song to let everybody know that I think we all should be speaking up. We are doing something amazing and we're not going anywhere. You know, we've always been here and you better get with it.
The immigrants.
And that is our show for the week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend, and join us back here on Monday.